Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I know the road like the back of my hand, but I still find it hard giving directions to the Arigna mining experience. I've even heard how a carload of tourists stopped and asked a couple of the lads cutting grass in the graveyard on the side of Chapel Hill for directions to the mining museum. "Do you see that bus coming down into the valley?" they were told. "If it was going the other way, you could follow it straight there." Unlike the Welsh and English coal mines, you see, found deep in the valleys, the Arigna mines stand on elevated sites. Technically speaking, they're not mine shafts. They're headings driven straight into the hillsides to follow the thin seams of horizontal coal beds sandwiched between the shale and the sandstone. When the mines were in full production, Honda 50 motorbikes were popular for getting miners to and from work on the mountain. Hondas without tax or insurance or indicators or brake lights. So it was said that when one miner got stopped by the guards, he had nothing on the bike, only the brother. And when asked where were they coming from, the miners, who were black from head to foot with coal dust at the end of their shift, said, "From the bakery." At least the miners of Arigna never had to contend with that daunting plunge deep into the bowels of the earth found in English or Welsh coal mines, or the gargantuan coal fields of Pittsburgh in the US, where a visiting Arigna miner sent word home how they'd just sunk a shaft so deep the bottom fell out of it. Still, the highlight for most visitors today is the tour underground. For even though you are as near as is humanly possible to 100% safe, you have to gather your courage to leave behind the comforting daylight above ground. And it is this feeling of unease as you step into the mouth of the mine that makes you aware straight away of the unusualness of the job. A particular kind of bravery was needed to spend your working days in such confined spaces, in dark, wet tunnels, where you had to pick your step with care amongst the steel rails and steel ropes, the jack-legged air picks, the coal cutting machines, the compressed air hoses, the long-necked drill called the goose, the hutches or small trams loaded with coal, the reek from burning fuse wire and spent gelignite, the pockets of smothering black damp, and the blare and reverberation of contained explosions. The force of these underground blasts, it should be said, decided by men who left school at the ages of 14 and 15 to work in the pits, yet had the dexterity to measure the precise amount of explosives needed to clear the coal face and not cave in that whole section of tunnel or even bring down the roof of the entire mine. So it comes as no surprise to the visitor to learn that even the most unconcerned Arigna miner at the start of the working day stopped to say a prayer in front of the picture of the Sacred Heart with the red bulb burning a short distance inside the entrance to the mine. For as one seasoned miner making the sign of the cross warned a newcomer, you could be talking to the man himself before the day is out. All told, you had over 300 men who truly knew the rough and the funny side of life underground, men with the ability to keep at bay the natural human dread of dark, enclosed spaces, while at the same time able to apply the intuitive mixture of brute force and ingenuity needed for the commercial transit of coal to the surface of the earth. Yet pride alone did not explain the Erigna miner's experience. Yes, you took pride in your skills, but you couldn't say at heart it was love of the job that had you working in the coal mines. You did it for the money. So, whenever industrial unrest brought work to a halt, the miners were, of course, angry with their employers. But they were also wrestling with the very nature of what it meant to work underground for a living. A rise in pay was important, but wages alone could never make up for the harshness of the job. There had to be respect for the skills passed from generation to generation of coal miners, and respect too for the humiliations and deprivations suffered daily, such a cruel distance beyond the reach of God's sweet daylight. To an outsider, the industrial unrest over the years in Erigna was about pay and conditions, but inwardly, it was an argument with fate. On the surface, the miners might have fought with their employers, but deep down, they were battling their destiny.
Here, this is home, blue green mountain, ancestors' bones. Here, the heart can heal, their wounded mind restored and made whole again.
Don't be afraid of the thunder, loving. It's only God making roads in heaven. That was my gentle grandmother's explanation when the lights went out, the sky was roaring, I was trembling, and my grandfather had gone in search of the elusive candles kept in storage for such emergencies. The explanation made absolute sense in its time and place, and more sense than when many years later I sat telling a new friend in a college canteen what my father worked at. Well, himself and his brothers work in a coal mine on the Leitrim side of the Erigna Mountains. I had just started studying sociology, so didn't think any claim to management or ownership of said coal mine would help me in my quest for new friends in UCD. I continued with stories of how my father and uncles, the Dernavogie-born Wynne brothers, fresh from London and the Kilburn digs, had persevered to build a road up the side of the mountain, dug a hole deep into the ground, and set to creating Ochakashel collieries. Looking back, my story sounded way less credible than the idea of the county council lorries servicing the road networks of heaven. This was my first adult moment of feeling overwhelming pride and of wanting to share this story, my family story, with the world. Coming from a family with a short coal mining tradition and growing up in Easter snow on the edge of the plains of Boyle and 20 miles from the epicentre of pit life, I possibly didn't have the authentic coal miner's daughter experience. I never thought it out of the ordinary that my father left home, clean as a new pin, and returned covered from head to boot in thick black coal dust. I never thought it odd that the heavy-duty hand cleaner Swarfiga was as normal a purchase in our house as fairy liquid was in our neighbours. And as is the privilege of the egocentric child, I never wondered what it was Dad actually did when he got to the other side of the journey. My earliest memory of the significance of pit life in my little world is of a sunny day in the late 60s driving from Easter snow to Sligo my Uncle Esty at the wheel and my mother and me in the back of the car. My father was sitting in the front, his finger wrapped in a cloth nappy, trying to stop the flow of blood and so save his index finger. The new compressor had arrived to the pit, and Joe, my father, being the youngest and most recently returned from London, was designated as the person to sort out this new contraption. Amidst the drama of that day, I had my first 99 on the steps of Sligo Hospital, and the finger was saved in the end. By the time I was 10, we had moved on to more serious corporate matters. The typewriter was brought home one evening, and I was taught to type, me being the natural choice as I was good at the piano. My father and I dedicated one evening each month to writing the letter of application for the explosives to the superintendent in Ballyconnell. It was many years later I realised none of my peers had shared such responsible after-school activities with their fathers. The text requesting the gelignite, detonators and feet of fuse still rolls off my adult tongue as if we had written it only last month. Over 30 years after the compressor incident, I found myself once again in Sligo General Hospital at my father's bedside. As the days closed in and he slowly resolved himself to death, I sat staring at his hands crossed on the white starched bedsheet, and then I noticed the coal dust embedded in the knuckle for almost 40 years, begin to appear darker than ever. And as he crossed over from a life wholesomely lived, he took the dust of the mountain with him. There's a long history of strife between miners and mine owners, but as far as I know, our small mine somehow avoided all of that. And at my father's funeral, watching the rows and rows of men, mostly clad in dark leather jackets, respectfully file past his coffin, I saw the depth of bonding and friendship and camaraderie that these men carried with them, a bond that triumphed over darkness and through dust, and lived on in their hearts long after they left the pit. There's not much left of Ó Chaisiel Collieries now. The red door I painted on the little office many summers ago, in my teenage effort to glamorise the family business in the world's least glamorous industry, still remains. But 25 odd years on, who needs glamour? There's a mine of proud memories for one Irish coal miner's daughter.
Get back out to that power station and switch on the power before I'm destroyed. It was Mrs. Molly Guihan, with her head covered in a black sludge of hair dye, which was rolling down her face. She had just been about to go under the hairdryer when the electricity went off in the hairdressers. Spotting me walking into Campbell's Hardware, she figured that because I worked in the power station, I could just go out there and switch the power back on for Drumshanbo. It was the era of regular power cuts due to industrial action in the 1970s, and I was the clerical officer in the Arigna coal burning power station, just 5 miles out the road from Drumshanbo in County Leitrim. There was no point in explaining the technicalities to Mrs. Guihan. She thought that our power station supplied power to Drumshanbo only, and that was it. Simple. Switch it on again. Things are never that simple. The Arigna Generating Station, commissioned in 1958 to burn coal from the Arigna mines, where nearly 400 people worked, produced 15 megawatts of electricity, or more simply, enough power to light 15,000 electric fires. It was difficult to explain to Mrs. Guihan with her hair in danger, that the 15 megawatts we produce was fed into the national grid and then distributed to the rest of the nation. She just wanted the electricity switched on in what she perceived as an emergency. My first impression of the Arigna Power Station was of a dirty, grey, dusty factory full of grinding machines with a billow of grey smoke emerging from its one chimney. The coal, delivered from the Arigna mines to the station in small trucks, was deposited in a large storage area for blending and then shoveled into a huge bunker from where it was fed into a mill, which ground it into a fine dust, before it was blown into the huge boiler. This boiler turned water into steam, and the steam turned the huge 15 megawatt turbine to create electricity. 63 men and one woman worked there when I came. Peggy Barry was the only woman, and she was always treated like a princess by everyone. The place was full of characters. The uniformed gateman, Tom McLaughlin, for example, always addressed people by their second name. He would call out to his sideman, Mick Gilroy, who operated the weighbridge, "Hey, Gilroy, are you making tea?" Francie Flynn, the man in charge of blending the coal, was always cheerful, despite having to work outside in all weathers, on a coal-muddied street. He was regularly harangued by his superiors about the coal quality, which by some miracle he was expected to turn from what was very low-grade coal into dry, volatile fuel. "What can I do?" he would shrug with a twinkle in his eye. I remember one time he had some very unusual blending to do when 2 tons of cannabis, the haul from a recent seizure by the drug squad, was disposed of in the Arigna boiler. There were cows staggering around fields within a 2-mile radius of the station as the chimney spewed out its drugged-fueled smoke. The huge quantities of ash produced by the station were stored in ash ponds, kept moist by a sprinkler system. This disposal problem was solved in later years when Angus Dunn, the station manager, discovered that Irish cement were able to use the ash in the manufacture of breeze blocks, among other things. Suddenly, we had a new byproduct, and we were exporting ash in huge quantities across the country to Irish cement plants. The Arigna power station burned 55,000 tonnes of coal per annum from the nearby Arigna mines until it closed in the early 1990s. It's sobering to think that one tanker ship could deliver the same quantity of coal to the giant Money Point power station in County Clare. I worked in Arigna for 20 wonderful years, where I met so many interesting characters, many of whom have populated my songs. I'm always conscious of the Arigna miners who worked in much tougher conditions to keep us in our jobs for all those years. I still live in Drumshambo, which is now my home. Sadly, there's just an empty space where the power station stood, but some artefacts from the station can be seen in the Arigna mining experience up the road. I still count the Arigna miners and the power station workers as my friends, and I live my life out here. And as for Molly Guihan, Molly eventually dried her hair by the fire in Sissy Giblin's across the street.
I think of the life of the miner who must work all his day underground, where his lamp light is all that will shine there, and it's dark and it's damp all around. It is 2 or 3 miles.
Coal mining is tough. It's hard, physical toil in the old-fashioned sense. Repetitive and exhausting. It's difficult to imagine why anyone would choose it as a job. But as a child growing up in rural North Leitrim, living literally in the shadow of the Arigna Mountains, I knew just how important, how essential its coal mines were to the life of my community. Although none of my family worked in the mines when I was growing up, my grandfather talked about the few times he put in at the pit, cycling long miles to reach a siding, then crawling through narrow, semi-flooded seams to hack at a wall of coal for hours. Almost every man in the area was a miner at some point in his life, supplementing meagre farm income with badly needed shift work. or fitting in his farm duties after a day at the pit. The miner's life was a very real prospect for boys growing up locally, until the pits closed for good in 1990. Not for girls, though. I knew that I would not be going down the mines, and nor did I, until decades later. Then, I was guided by an ex-miner showing a group around his former workplace, the pit machinery, now museum artefacts. Some people on the tour balked at the last minute and refused to go in. I thought of the men who'd had to trudge into the mine day after day, regardless of their fears, and labour in the dark and the dirt. So, as a child, I watched the open-topped pit lorry trundling up the road, depositing grimy miners at the roadside, and I knew I would never join them. I can't say I was very sorry about that. Yet, there was a kind of tired cachet about these men, a brotherhood of shared cigarettes and chronic coughs. Everyone knew they were doing real, important work. But for the women who could not and would never be miners, life was also hard work. Or rather, the work was a different kind of hard, maybe because it was not acknowledged in the same way. While husbands, brothers, fathers and sons toiled below ground, the women ran the farms above. All the usual housework, cooking, cleaning, baking, mending and childcare had to be done. But they also had that extra responsibility of managing the farmsteads. The fathering, the milking, dunging out and gardening fell under their remit, as well as the back-breaking seasonal planting and harvesting. I dallied often in the houses of these women, tidy and warm places that welcomed a chatty child, ostensibly keeping company, but really just getting underfoot. I took it for granted that they were always there to make me feel at home, offering whatever nice treat was going and chatting about local news, telling jokes on the go. "And how are you getting on at school, Agra? Does the master give you many slaps?" Katie would ask, changing her Wellingtons for house shoes, tying on an apron before bursting into a giggling description of fierce teachers she had known. Looking back, I have enormous appreciation for these methodical multitaskers. Fitting in the ironing between carrying buckets of nuts to hungry calves, feeding squawking hens and baking a quick cake of soda bread in a solid fuel range that had to be cleaned and stoked from morning to evening. These women were the pillars of my childhood world. Their work was physically and mentally demanding, and it was largely unrecognised. That didn't stop them from doing it with dignity and humour. When a coal-blackened, sore and exhausted son or husband returned from the mines, he had to be tended and fed. But the woman of the house had no downtime or well-earned spontaneous afternoon of minorly camaraderie in Flynn's pub. "Arisher, we'll have a cup of tea and then we might get a start on the praties," you'd hear before the next job was tackled. Many young women opted for London or New York, leaving behind ranks of hardy bachelors. But many also stayed. My grandfather, Michael Woods, the sometime miner who married one of these resilient women, would say he couldn't blame the ones who did leave, as the life they faced here was so hard. He understood it better than most, his wife dying suddenly, too young, leaving him to rear six children. So when I think of the hard life of miners, I remember the Kathleens, the Marys and the Teresas of my past. Strong, warm and hard-working, women with hearts of solid gold. I like to think that they knew, even if few said it out loud, that they were just as indispensable to us and to the community as the coal mines were for all those years.
The rock dust is the worst. Many a good man it killed. The speaker is Tommy Gralton, and we're leaning on the stone wall of his farmhouse in Foulchie, Tarman, in March 2009. I've come back with my friend and colleague Peter Woods to make a radio documentary about a bitter strike in the coal pits of Arrigna 40 years earlier, in the winter of 68 and spring of 69. My uncle, Michael Guihan, Mickey Curley, led the strike. My godfather, Charlie Smith, a firesman or foreman in the mines, continued to work. Tommy Gralton was one of 12 men from Tarman persuaded back to work by the mine owners in a plan to break the strike. Like all of that group, he was ostracised by his former workmates, called a scab, and the deep divisions that cracked the community never fully healed. My uncle and godfather, close neighbours, never spoke again, though once or twice they worked together in a silent mehel of haymaking or farm work to help someone in need, then resumed their proud and stubborn positions, each at the window of his house, a few hundred yards apart, looking out at a road where the open-topped pit lorry once rattled the miners to and from work. The history of that strike may never be told in full, but like all strikes in a small place, it was hard and divisive. The men wanted a five-day week and a small pay increase. Some wanted better working conditions. They were effectively locked out when an unofficial dispute flared up weeks before an official strike was due to start. For 6 months, from November to April, 250 men and their families struggled to survive without wages, without work. My uncle helped put food on tables in Arrigna, bringing cabbage and potatoes from his farm in Cartranbeg. Local dances and bazaars raised money for a hardship fund. Shopkeepers like Eddie Guihan and Michael Rourke gave credit, left boxes of groceries on doorsteps at night. The local clergy sided with the mine owners. The parish priest called to my grandmother, told her Mickey was a communist, asked her to persuade her son to call off the strike. Devout and all as she was, she ran him. The priest in Arrigna organised what he called a women's ballot, hoping to put pressure on the men to go back to work. The women burned the ballot outside the church. I remembered the strike from childhood. I was 8 and heard all the news and argument in our kitchen. I remembered the day the striking men marched from Arrigna to Carrickenshannon. Photos show the long line of them walking towards the old bridge at McCran's pub. The homemade placards tell their own story. We want justice. We have no sanitation, no baths, no canteen. We lie and work in water. No change in working conditions in 30 years. At first, Tommy Gralton says he can't remember the strike. Then, slowly, it all comes back, and he tells it. It was a wrong thing we done, he says. No man should ever pass a picket. And did they ever thank you? The owners, I ask. Oh, no. Oh, Jay, no, the same as we never done it. In the recording from that day, you can hear the whirl of phlegm in his chest, the dust rooted deep. Tommy says he listened to the radio programme in June, tell all the neighbours about it. We shake hands on that pledge. That was a Sunday evening, bright with birdsong. Tommy dies on Wednesday, and within a week, I'm back in Tarman for his funeral. Old workmates from both sides of the strike help to dig and fill his grave. His pit lamp is carried to the altar for the offertory procession. They're almost all gone now, the old miners, the men we interviewed for that programme, the long strike. Charlie Smith, Jim McKenna, Mick Yank, and younger men too, Francie O'Brien, Packy McPartlin. My uncle died in April of this year. In hospital in Manor Hamilton, in the months before he dies, he spits up deep black mucus, coal dust on and from the lung, 30 years after he last went underground. He never set foot in the mining museum. The true story was too hard to warrant reminding of it. But I think he knew that the strike he led was just and right, and changed the given narrative. History was no longer the preserve of the rich or powerful, no longer the other man's story. Mickey Curley and his men made history, and the silent windows of the empty houses are witness to their struggle.
That edition of Sunday Miscellany was produced by Aoife Nic Comeric and rebroadcast this morning to mark the 30th anniversary of the closure of the Arigna coal mines. The written contributions this morning included The Arigna Mining Experience by Brian Layden. You also heard Life Between Easter Snow and Slieve Éireann by Caroline Wynne. Charlie McGettigan brought us My Life in Power. Miner for a Heart of Gold was by Yvonne Woods. And we also had Dust on the Lung, Striking a Seam of Memory by Vincent Woods. This morning's music choices were Sanctuary, with lyrics by Vincent Woods, music by Martin O'Connor, and it was sung by Mary McPartlin. Paddy Dignan, who worked in the Arigna mines, played a reel on flute called House on the Hill. Life of a Miner was written and performed by Charlie McGettigan. Then we heard Three Hornpipes, Murphy's, the Liverpool and the Wexford, played on fiddle by Joe Lackey Gallagher, who delivered coal around Arigna for many years, and Miner's Song by Trevor Knight at the end, performed by Trevor Knight and Ed Dean on guitar and vocals. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy. For more from Sunday Miscellany and other RTE cultural programmes, see rte.ie/culture.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.